I am Planta on the line. This is thecommentary.ca. Years ago, I flunked a first-year course in linguistics. I suppose I was uninterested or bored, or I simply didn't apply myself. However, one of the more delightful books to hit my desk this season is Strange Bedfellows, The Private Lives of Words. Its author, Howard Rischler, joins me now. It's a fascinating, informative, and engrossing book on a great number of words, their origin, original meaning, and for some of them, where the English language has stolen them from. It's also often amusing, and I find myself still, weeks after getting the book, dipping into it. Howard Rischler is a lifetime logophile who was a language columnist for many years. He's written five other books on language, including The Dead Sea Scroll Palindromes, Can I Have a Word With You, and Take My Words, A Wordaholic's Guide to the English Language. Strange Bedfellows, the latest, is published by Ronsdale Press. I'm very pleased to welcome to the Planta Online program from Montreal this day, Howard Rischler. Good morning, Mr. Rischler.
Well, it's a good morning, even though the Habs lost, but, you know, it had to come to an end.
Yeah, it did, didn't it? If I said that this was a meticulous book, I guess I'd be insulting you, wouldn't I?
Well, it depends whether I want to put on my etymological hat or my lexicographical hat, you know, so I have a lot of hats. So, but, I mean, the reality is in English, there's not too many words that at some point haven't changed meanings. And this pertains particularly to adjectives, which are more likely to have value judgments. Meticulous, as you mentioned, is one of those words that definitely has changed its meaning over the years, the same way like words like nice and fond and silly have changed the words. But the thing is that meticulous would seem to most people to be a compliment. I suppose there's some people who are people like me who actually have a very messy death might find it, you know, perhaps, you know, a little bit of a put down. But at one point it really had really more the sense of being overzealous. But over time this sense lost its meaning. And it came, you know, it just changed its meaning to be, like, to more or less to mean precise. So, but words as values change in society, this happens all the time. And I once wrote an article about the seven deadly sins. And if you look at all the seven sins over time, the seven deadly sins, which were very deadly, now most of them are looked at as compliments. Of course, sloth isn't exactly regarded as complimentary. But, you know, pride, if you really want to show the negative side of pride, you really have to look at a word like hubris, envy, perhaps maybe the Wall Street made greed and envy somewhat fashionable. So, in fact, you know, luxury in itself at one point really carried a negative connotation, but nowadays something which is luxurious just seems to imply sumptuous living and doesn't really give you a hint of any sort of negative connotation.
Yeah. For the layman, as I said off the top, I flunked that first-year linguistics course. What's the difference between lexicography and etymology?
Well, the thing is, a lexicographer is somebody who makes dictionaries or helps in compiling a dictionary, where etymology is, not to be confused with entomology, which is the study of ants, and A-N-T, not A-U-N-T, is basically just the study of word origins.
Uh-huh.
So they're very separate parts. I suppose you could say that etymology is a part of lexicography. In fact, if you look at a major dictionary, like the Oxford English Dictionary, they will have the etymology of all words. But, you know, the lexicographer looks at all aspects of a word, the semantics of the word, the origins, you know, and so on.
And you consider yourself both?
Well, I consider myself more an etymologist because I study etymology. The thing is, I have never as such partaken in the compiling of a dictionary. Mind you, I do have my basic Bible is the Oxford English Dictionary because it carries the meaning of every word that's ever existed in the English dictionary from the year 1000, and it will trace the changes in meaning of the word over at least, we'll have at least one meaning per century. And in the cases of some words, you know, you could have like 100 meanings, like words like set and run and whatever have countless meanings. But words are always in a state of flux. They're always changing meanings, and it's really necessary to be able to have something like the Oxford English Dictionary, because it's, in a sense, it's the final arbiter. And I must say, English is blessed because it's the only language that has a dictionary that traces the words in its language for that length of time, and does it so meticulously, if I may use meticulous.
Yeah. Now, so it's not only a chronicle, it is an arbiter. It does decide.
Well, it isn't an arbiter anymore, because the thing is, our lexicography has become a totally a descriptive venture, not prescriptive, whereas perhaps like 25 years ago, dictionaries would talk more about proper usage. But the general idea right now among linguists is that basically the way people use words is really determines is proper usage. And the reality is that when everybody starts using a word incorrectly, that's when the word changes meaning. And a lot of words, you can see a process like that. For example, you get some pedants who give you a really hard time about the word decimate, that it should only refer to killing one-tenth. Well, it hasn't referred to killing one-tenth for at least like 50 years, and maybe one out of 100 people will use it in that sense. At this point, if you say the ranks are decimated, most people get the impression that it was a hell of a lot more than 10% of people who suffered. So words are always in a state of flux, and even if the word changed the meaning because of a mistake, once enough people use that word in that sense, then that, all intents and purposes, that becomes the meaning.
And
there are some people who don't like that, but
yeah,
it's just a reality.
And do you find that popular culture is perhaps responsible for words changing their meaning just simply by using words?
Oh, definitely. And the reality is that every generation puts their own imprints on language. Of course, when I'm like 61, and when I was like 20, there were a lot of terms that people would look at and like, my God, it was almost looked at as black slang, words like uptight. I remember I was, not that I go to synagogues often, but a couple years ago I remember the rabbi at a synagogue talking about freaking out.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's hard to imagine a rabbi in the 60s who wasn't on pot talking about freaking out, but nowadays it's become, you know, very common. So, popular culture, slang, the point is a lot of words that which at one point were slang have moved into the normal vernacular. So that's a normal process of language.
And then does it happen rapidly now?
It happens very rapidly now, and I think the pace is even increasing that much. And, you know, there's a lot of forces that work on language. For example, you take euphemisms. Like certain words that came into the language at one point have totally changed meanings. The word retarded actually came into the English language as a euphemism because people didn't like the word idiot. And of course, nowadays, if you refer to somebody as retarded, it's not a euphemism.
Mm-hmm.
It's an insult. But at one point, it was considered, you know, a kind way of saying, replacing the word idiot. The same way a word like cemetery, nobody would think of it as a euphemism, but cemetery just means sleeping place. And what happens once words become, you know, people get used to it, we replace words like cemetery with terms like eternal garden. So, like, words are always going through a process of a flux, and who people are in power determine the meaning of words. Obviously, a governess and a mistress do not have the same sort of cachet as a governor or a mister. So, you know, there's all these forces on language continuously.
And we're still borrowing words from other languages, right?
Well, we're borrowing words, and you had mentioned in your introduction that English is stolen words from other language. In one of my books, I talked about, I prefer the term that English sleeps around. Because English is a language which borrows from every language in the world, and has been very proud to do it. It's probably the only major language that has never had a language academy. And the reason for that is very peculiar to the history of English. There was a long time in English history where the elites in England regarded English as a second-class language.
So basically, the language was able to evolve and change grammatically without a lot of efforts from, you know, from elites to control it. So you really have a situation like perhaps the greatest writer who's ever lived, Shakespeare, was able to do whatever he wanted with the language, because at that time, in the 16th and early 17th century, people didn't really care that much about people playing around with language. Perhaps 100 years later, you know, the rules started to come into effect. But English has a very distinct history and has always been prepared to borrow words from other languages and to regard it as an enrichment rather than a corruption.
Now, Yiddish, people say that's a dying language, but I hear it a lot on television, on sitcoms and the sort. So I tend to think that it's not dying. I mean, is it?
Yeah. When you say Yiddish, the thing is, like, what you're hearing is not really Yiddish. What you're hearing is Yinglish. And, like, there's a lot of words that have really come into the English vernacular, and not necessarily just by Jewish people. You know, so many people use the word schlep, for example. I remember once I was in New Mexico, and the weatherman who said, in weather there's only bopkas going on, which means nothing.
Yeah.
And there's all sorts of terms which have come into the English. And what happens a lot of times when the word is in the English language, it has a different meaning than the meaning in Yiddish. But to get back to your point about Yiddish, is Yiddish dying? Well, in a sense, it has diminished, because you really don't have that many people who speak Yiddish as a you know, as an everyday language. And those who do speak the language are ultra-Orthodox. And the reason they speak it is because they believe that Hebrew is a holy language that should be reserved for prayer. So I think to some extent Yiddish is diminished, because you don't have, like, great writers coming out right now, like Isaac Bashevis Singer and others of that ilk, who are enriching the language. So you really have only a subset of people who live in Yiddish. I mean, obviously, not too many people in Israel speak Yiddish, and those who do are probably 80 years and over.
Well, when someone offers you an avocado or talks about their porcelain collection, do you giggle?
No, but I become aroused.
those two words take their meaning from body parts, right?
Yeah, that's right. Sometimes I find it very humorous, some of the things that words remind people of. So in the case of avocado actually comes from a word from the Inca language. And the Incas were impressed with the fact that the avocado seemed to have a similarity in shape to a testicle. And the thing is, it became called an avocado because the original word in Inca could not be pronounced by the Spanish conquistadors, and it was somewhat similar for the word for lawyers, which was avocado. So in my book, I speculate this is why lawyers are such ballsy people, because of the etymology of the word. But it's really amazing some of the words remind people of certain words. Like in many languages, the words mouse and muscle are connected. Muscle, as in the muscle in your arm, because in many languages, including English, Latin, Serbo-Croatian, Arabic, people have thought that a muscle in your arm resembles a scurrying mouse. Now, I would probably only think that if I was, like, slightly sozzled, but, you know, this has been a common thought among people in many different cultures. So there obviously is something to it. So there's just all sorts of incredible stories with words. Another word that comes to mind, I'm trying to think, is the word bowel. In Latin, the word botellus is the same word for intestine and for sausage. And I guess it comes from the time where certain soldiers would look at their slain comrades and think that their stomachs sort of resemble sausages. So, that, you know, this may sort of diminish somebody's, you know, appetite for sausages, but that is the human mind. It makes comparisons between different words and different objects, and in a sense, every word was once a metaphor. Every word was once a poem. So that's what I find so fascinating about words. There's so much in the individual word.
Now, chop suey, that's a word that we think is Asian, or Chinese at least, right? Is it?
Chop suey. Well,
we tend to think of when we order it at a restaurant, say a Chinese restaurant. I think I read in the book that it doesn't mean the actual dish. Rather, it's a. I believe.
Oh yeah, that's right. Yeah, you're right. You reminded me. It's actually chop suey is actually a culinary prank, because the food, which was once thought by most Americans to be the quintessential dish of China,
yeah.
All it really means is mixed bits. In Cantonese, so but of course it's still one of the major if you ask 10 people to name a word from Chinese, chop suey would be on most people's list, as one of the major words from Chinese. So yeah, that's the other thing about language. A lot of words which come from languages that one would never expect. Pedigree really comes from the expression in French, pied de grue, because there used to be on family tree graphs certain lines which people thought resembled the foot of a crane, and that's what a grue is. Technically a pedigree is the foot of a crane. So this may sort of somewhat diminish somebody's pride in their pedigree. But there are a lot of words that come from languages, because words change over time. And it's really hard to notice, the origin of the word. Another good example is the word shampoo. Most people would be surprised that shampoo comes from Hindi, so out of India. So there are a lot of words like that.
Now, okay, whether it's O-K-A-Y or O.K. H.L. Mencken said that was an Americanism that they'd invented. Is that correct?
Well, it's probably, some people will regard it as one of the quintessential Americanisms, and it's probably, one of the mantras that you will hear around the world in people using the word okay. It's sort of become part of a global language word, like okay and cool and whatever. It really has a very interesting history, because at one point, people thought that the word came from a presidential race where in the 19th century, where somebody was, his nickname was Old Knickerbocker, if I remember. But actually, it really comes from a tendency in the 19th century, where people had liked to abbreviate everything. And some of them were very strange things, like small potatoes would be called SP, and RTBS could be remains to be seen. So okay, really, what it really stood for was all correct, but all was rendered as like oil, O-Y-L, and then correct was spelled K-O-R-R-E-C-T. And then what happened is, because it really had this cachet, when this campaign started sometime in the 19th century, then it was picked up by this American politician who I think was Van Buren. So his nickname was Old Kinderhook. So that sort of entrenched sort of the belief. But it's also one of those words that there's all sorts of phony etymologies, what's called technically folk etymologies, and some of them are so entrenched that you almost hate telling people that their etymologies are wrong. Like, I've had to tell people that golf does not stand for gentlemen only, ladies forbidden. It's a very popular one in Quebec for some reason.
Yeah.
And then some of them are derogatory terms, like the term, the derogatory term for an Italian, which, that uses WAP. A lot of people believe it comes from without papers, the W and O in without and the P, which is not true. So, but a lot of these etymologies are really entrenched, and I guess people love a good story, and sometimes the story is better than the truth. So sometimes it's very hard dissuading people that they're wrong.
What influence has the internet had, Howard?
Come again?
What influence has the internet had on words?
The influence of the internet. Well, I think with the internet, it hasn't had so much an influence on words, but obviously you have a dissemination of words faster. So, like, it probably speeds up the process whereby a word could be accepted in the dictionary, because what would happen is most dictionaries will have a process that for a word to be accepted into the dictionary, it has to be used by X number of people, over a certain period of time. And now, obviously, with the internet allows the word to be spread, so it probably increases the rate at which words can be adopted into English, and obviously words into other languages. But I think the major effect of the internet is we still don't know how it will affect language, because obviously when you send an email, what is it? Is it, are you writing? You are, but you're in a way you're talking. So it's sort of its own form of communication. And when we write an email, we don't write as formally as we do when we write a letter. So I think we still don't know how it's going to affect language and whether it will really hasten change in grammatical rules. For example, when I write internet emails, I'll normally write B stroke C instead of because, T-H-R-U instead of the proper way of spelling through. Will this change over time? Will people start spelling this the word this way? And will it be accepted? I don't think anybody really knows. But obviously there is a tendency in English to always shorten words. So it's very possible that over time, if enough people start spelling through T-H-R-U, that they're going to forget that, that it really should be spelled a different way. And I won't even get into texting, because that's something where the spelling is totally out of whack, totally different.
Now, I understand that you're working on three other books at the moment?
Yeah, I'm working on three other books. One of them is a collection of word puzzles which I've developed. The idea behind it as we, I don't know if I can put you in this illustrious category as of a baby boomer, but my attitude, my feeling is that as we baby boomers get older, our warranty on our body parts runs out, which it has probably already, that we are going to avoid activities such as bungee jumping and javelin catching and try something more sedentary. So, and I think there is some research to show that working on word puzzles actually keeps the mind fluid and helps helps the mind stay young. So I've entitled my book Brain Dancing, and then in brackets, Guaranteeing to Ward Off Dementia. And but of course, I won't put that guarantee in writing. And then I have a book which I'm working on, which is a book on etymology for children. And then I'm working on a book on sort of the philosophy of humor and how humor has changed over the ages. So that's what I'm working on.
Well, we'll look forward to those books. I've become a fan of your work now because of this book. I've really enjoyed the conversation today, Howard, and continued good luck with the book.
My God, is the 15 minutes up?
We've gone to 23 now, so.
My God. Okay, but you don't charge overtime, do you?
No, we don't.
Okay, good.
No, but people should buy the book. It's called Strange Bedfellows, The Private Lives of Words. There are some great stories in this book. It's published by our friends at Ronsdale Press. Howard Rischler, its author, on the line from Montreal in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.